Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. To many, Thurgood Marshall symbolized the epitome of success for any student of law when he was confirmed to join the highest court in the land. As the first African-American on the United States Supreme Court, his place in history would be assured. But by 2010, during Elena Kagan's confirmation hearings, conservatives in the Senate treated her clerkship for Marshall as a, as one outlet put it, a stain on her resume. This was the man whose numerous legal successes, almost exclusively on behalf of marginalized blacks across the Jim Crow South, included the landmark Brown v. Board of Education. Still, more than anyone, Marshall stressed the need for continual progress. In 1978, he explained why in a speech at his law school alma mater, Howard University.
There are people that tell us today, take it easy, man. You made it. But again, I remind you of what Charlie Houston said. You got to be better, boy. Be careful of these people who say, you've made it. Take it from me, it has not been solved.
Award-winning journalist and author Will Haygood has written about the life and times of Thurgood Marshall in his latest book. It's entitled Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed America. Will Haygood joins us now. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Will will be speaking tonight at the Lincoln Theater. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Will, Thurgood Marshall certainly is well known. Would he have been so well known if he hadn't been appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes, absolutely, for the simple fact that in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, he traveled this country as a civil rights attorney for the NAACP, going in and out of state courthouses, federal courthouses, filing lawsuits for his plaintiffs who were more often than not blacks, who were fighting for voting rights, housing rights, job rights. There were four seminal cases that he took to the Supreme Court and won. One was Smith v. Allwright, which was a Texas voting rights case when blacks had been forbidden to vote in the Democratic primary. He won that case. Another one was Shelley v. Kramer, which was about a housing issue. And another one was Sweat v. Painter, which integrated the University of Texas Law School. And his titanic achievement, Brown v. Board of Education, which desegregated, in theory, the U.S. public school system. But the Brown decision was a psychological engine to tell the country that in no way was Plessy v. Ferguson morally correct and separate but equal was immoral as well.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American member of the U.S. Supreme Court. My guest is Will Haygood. He's an award-winning journalist and author. He's also a native of Columbus. His latest book is entitled Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed Changed America. It has been chosen, the selection, it's been made chosen for the city's reading assignment. It's a first for Columbus. They're asking everybody in the city to read a book over the course of 6 weeks. And yours has been chosen as that book this year for the first time.
Yes, I'm very honored by that. I think any writer would be. I was born and raised in this city and went to the libraries on the weekends. A lot of Saturday mornings spent at the libraries. There was never a car in my family, and so I could transport myself by going to the library. I could go to Tokyo by reading about it. I could go to Paris, France by reading about it. I could go to Mississippi and Georgia by reading about it. And so to have this kind of honor for this book that's been published on the 50th anniversary of the 1965 Voting Rights Act means a lot. I think it's a book about politics, about history, about blacks, the black struggle for freedom, in this country. It wasn't given. It had to be fought for. And there were a lot of blood and tears around that struggle. There were a lot of wonderful, great people, blacks and whites, men and women and children fighting for that cause. And Thurgood Marshall was at the epicenter of it.
He was the quintessential go-to guy for the NAACP. He basically helped start the legal arm of the organization.
Yes.
He traveled constantly. Like I said, go-to guy. What was his mission at that point? What was his if they had a mission statement at the time, what would it have been?
This is interesting. There was a flag that hung outside of the NAACP headquarters in the 1930s. Marshall saw that flag every day he went to work, and it said, "A man was lynched today." So the flag was there, and they would unfurl it when someone was lynched in a southern state. And so it was a constant reminder of his need. And I think we sometimes forget that there was not a federal arm of the Justice Department as it relates to civil rights in the Deep South until the late 1950s under Eisenhower. So Marshall was working in the South without any kind of a safety net, filing these lawsuits on behalf of his clients who maybe have been sentenced to death and were not guilty. A lot of kangaroo court cases. The men who killed Emmett Till got off, and there were multiple cases like that. But Marshall looked at the country and said to himself that if I'm going to be effective in taking down Plessy v. Ferguson, I'm going to have to build building blocks. So I'm going to have to get a major lawsuit with education, a major lawsuit with voting rights, a major lawsuit with housing rights. And then by the time the 1960s rolled around and President Kennedy and President Johnson started thinking of civil rights, well, they could roll what Marshall did into the 1964 Civil Rights Bill and into the 1965 Voting Rights Act. So you had asked, what was Marshall doing when he was traveling during these 30-something years? He was laying a foundation that would become kind of the Magna Carta for freedom in the 20th century in this country.
And Magna Carta is not a small way to put it, because on the other side of the coin, they were constructing a screed against black freedom.
Yes, and these were very powerful U.S. senators from the Deep South. They were called barons. They had large staffs, men such as Senator James Eastland of Mississippi, Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina, Senator Sam Ervin of North Carolina, Senator John McClellan of Arkansas. These were the men who in the 40s and 50s revered the South. They were on the cover of national magazines like Time and Newsweek. They were considered legends, and they loathed Thurgood Marshall, not only for his victories, voting rights victories, but the 1954 case. Sam Ervin won his Senate seat because he promised in 1953, "I'll go to the U.S. Senate and I will thwart anyone who's trying to implement Brown v. Board." So reputations were made in the effort to stop Brown v. Board of Education after it had been passed into law.
And these guys were openly racist. This is not genteel-like approaches. These guys were – Eastland was – well, his father had lynched a man himself or killed, murdered a man.
Yes.
A black man.
Yes. James Eastland was one year old when his father found out that a black man had been still living on his property in Doddsville, Mississippi, his plantation. Eastland had thrown him off. This man had a girlfriend there and moved into her little shack. And so Eastland and another man rode to get this gentleman, whose name was Luther. They drove to kick him off of the property. Luther heard the horses coming. He got his rifle. He opened the door, and the shooting began. And Mr. Eastland lay dead. This would have been James Eastland, the senator. This would have been his uncle.
His namesake.
Yeah, his namesake. And so Woods Eastland, the father of later the senator, led a massive boycott to find Luther and Mary. They were the two people in the shack. They were two black sharecroppers. They fled into the woods, and they were on the run for 7 days.
It was shocking in the course of that manhunt that they just killed other people randomly. If they saw them and they looked like they were running from them, they'd shot them down.
Yes, it was tragic. Much like in the with the Emmett Till case, when searchers were looking for Emmett Till's body, they would drag rivers and they would bring up
others.
Black men who had been lynched as well. The same thing happened in this manhunt. They were caught and they were taken to a local jail. But Woods Eastland in his posse strong-armed the sheriff and pulled these two people out of that jail, took them into the woods, sliced off their fingers, sliced off their ears, and cut out their tongue, and then set them on fire, and then laid the bodies in front of a black church as a threat to any church people who might help blacks in the future. Now, that story shocked me because I had never heard about it, but I found a good amount of information about it when I went to Mississippi and pored over the Eastland archives for about 5 days.
And once again, Eastland was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee.
Yes, and so—
This was not—
No.
This was his uncle or his father who hunted these people down.
Yes. Now, I'm not—I mean, Eastland was only a one—you know, he was just about to be born, actually. His mother was pregnant with him when this lynching took place. But that was the type of attitude that Eastland, that the young Eastland grew up in. His sister was named Miss Confederacy around 1956.
Crowned Miss Confederacy, yeah.
She was crowned that. And Eastland had gotten on the, Senator Eastland had gotten on the Senate floor and referred to blacks as less than human. And so you have Thurgood Marshall, who has waged this battle for equal rights throughout the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and then 1967 comes along, and the very people who he has harmed their way of living, there's a showdown coming now. The Judiciary Committee is dominated by Southerners. It's chaired by a Southerner. The hour has arrived. Lyndon Johnson, a Southerner himself, thinks he can get Marshall onto the court, but he knows it's going to be tough. Mm-hmm. Every Senate hearing for every Supreme Court nominee prior to Thurgood Marshall had lasted less than a day. Marshall's went 5 days, stretched over 12 days, and his nomination set in limbo for 5 weeks. So a lot of tension there, a lot of tension, a lot of anger.
A lot of drama. My guest is Will Haygood. He's an award-winning journalist and author of many books, including his latest. It's entitled Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed America. you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can join the conversation by emailing us at allsides@wosu.org or go ahead and check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Thurgood Marshall was a crusading attorney and civil rights activist who led the fight for school desegregation and equal pay for black teachers. In 1967, President Lyndon B. Johnson nominated him for the United States Supreme Court. That in itself was extraordinary, a black man in the highest court in the land. But the Senate judiciary hearings that led to his confirmation shed light on the ugly truth about the bastions of racism and segregation in the land of the free and the home of the brave. Award-winning author and journalist Will Haygood has written about all of it in his new book entitled Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed America. He'll speak tonight at the Lincoln Theater. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Once again, Will Haygood, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be here.
When he decided to go into law, it seemed almost without a question that he would use the law to help African Americans. He was always of that ilk of person. He could have probably prospered and become a great lawyer, and a lot others did. Not many, but others did of his day. What was it? Where did that trajectory come from?
His father, Willie Marshall, was a man full of pride. He worked as a waiter and as a steward. He took his son down to the courthouses in Maryland. Marshall himself, Thurgood, as a young student, memorized, for the most part, the U.S. Constitution, and he carried it around with him in his pockets. And he could never understand, well, it says here in the U.S. Constitution that blacks should have equal rights, the same rights as whites. And so in Marshall's mindset, this is a great mountain to climb to try to secure equal rights for blacks. And it became his mission. He was not after Howard Law School. He graduated number one in his class, but no Wall Street law firms or white shoe law firms were looking to hire blacks in the 1930s. So Marshall joined the NAACP in 1933.
Recruited by his former professor, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Charles Hamilton Houston, mm-hmm. Great attorney, Harvard man, Harvard Law School, a great, great, brilliant mind. And Houston took Marshall throughout the South for the first time, and that's when Thurgood really saw a lot of raw racism up close. And he started thinking of a way to attack the lack of education. He knew, which is still true today, that you have to capture a child's thinking apparatus, a child's brain, when they're like, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6. Those early years are important. So if the little black child is only going to school 2 hours a day and the white child is going to school a full day in the 1930s, well, the little black child falls further and further and further behind. There's a very poignant story in the book from South Carolina. There were these two brothers, little black kids, 8 and 9, and they both had to work in the fields. And one would go to school in the morning, his 2 hours, and he would come back and teach his brother what he had learned. And the next day, his brother would go to school, and he would come back and teach his brother what he had learned, because They never could be absent from the fields at the same time. And Thurgood Marshall saw stories like this repeatedly. The hunger to learn was an explosive hunger. You can't keep that in a box.
It was interesting, too, during those trips with his Houston, mentor in Houston, with Charles Houston, how they would document everything they saw.
Yes.
We met two boys today. This is what we met, a father and a son. They just documented every single thing they saw.
Yes.
Because no one had ever really done that yet.
No one had done it, and they knew that facts speak loudly. If a school district in South Carolina was spending $8,000 a year on transportation buses for the white kids and spending $500 a year on transportation for the black kids, well, that's a wide gap. And you can see that on paper, and the numbers don't lie. And Marshall had an arsenal of numbers. He went on a fact-finding mission. He had saw enough that one summer that he knew if he could have any impact in civil rights, that he would commit himself to it through the law. The University of Maryland would not accept blacks, so Marshall one day recruited a black man by the name of Donald Murray, and he said, "Hey, I want you to apply to the University of Maryland." And Mr. Murray said to Mr. Marshall, "Well, I won't get in because I'm black." Marshall said, "I know you won't get in, but I need you to apply, because when you are rejected, I'm going to sue them." And
he needed action, someone to take an action.
Yes,
right?
He needs someone to take action. So Murray applied, got denied admission because he was black. Marshall sued the University of Maryland Law School, the law school that his mother would have loved him to have gone to.
Because that's where he's from.
Yep, because he's from Baltimore. And Marshall won. Now, Donald Murray was frightened to walk onto the campus. Thurgood Marshall put on his trench coat and his fedora and said, "Let's go." And Thurgood Marshall chaperoned him back and forth to the campus much of that first year and dared anyone to bother Donald Murray. But that was Marshall's mission. He would see a wrong and he would fall back on the law and he would correct it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the life and times of Thurgood Marshall. He's the first African-American nominated to the United States Supreme Court. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Philip in Newark, you're on the air. Hi, Philip.
Good morning. I'm Ms. Fisher. Great show, as always.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Haygood, very good to hear from you, and congratulations on your book. I want to make a comment, and you were speaking about earlier Plessy versus Ferguson, which is an 1890s case in Louisiana. But my father was a participant in World War II, and the factors of Plessy versus Ferguson were as far-ranging as to then the United States Army Air Forces segregated our citizens and my father into the 99th Fighter Squadron and 477th, and that the groups and squadrons that were later on known as the Tuskegee Airmen. But it was that my father was stationed at Freeman Field or Camp Atterbury, 1945,
mm-hmm.
and the Freeman Field Mutiny, which Mr. Marshall at that particular time was at least consulted upon, because there was over 100 officers that were incarcerated for their supposed crime was refusing to sign an order that you will not go to the officers' club, and they created a separate even club for that. But your comments on those particular things, and then also I've been an admirer of your particular work, and also Mary Hutton, a friend of yours, says to say hello, and that I'm based in New York. I would really like to hear your comments on it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Philip. You did write about his works to as far as the military went and the desegregation of the military.
Yes. There was a famous mutiny case in the San Francisco area, the Port Chicago mutiny, where the black soldiers were ordered to load bombs onto ships, and some of these missiles and bombs were live, hot. You know, if you dropped it or it rolled, it might blow up.
And it was just the black servicemen or the black.
Yes. Navy.
Navy, that's right.
Navy. And one night, these bombs, they did blow, and there were multiple deaths and multiple injuries. And the Navy men were ordered, the black Navy men were ordered to go back to work days later, and they refused to do it. And they said, no, we're being given this extremely dangerous work. There are no safeguards, and we are in harm's way. And so they were court-martialed. And their mothers and fathers sent a SOS out. And that SOS, like most SOS from sailors and soldiers, landed on the desk of Thurgood Marshall. And he went to Port Chicago and advised their lawyers about what to do. Some of them got off, and some of them were sentenced. And then years later, many of those sailors were exonerated in the 1980s. And so Marshall was the main go-to lawyer for military, black military personnel through the decades, 30s, 40s, and 50s, who had these sharp grievances about the ways they had been treated.
You wrote that when President Johnson decided to nominate Thurgood Marshall, he said, "Thurgood, I'm nominating you because you're a lot like me, bigger than life, and we come from the same kind of people." What was he talking about?
They were both men who knew what it was like to get up in the morning and have for breakfast a simple plate of grits and sausage. Neither of them were born with a silver spoon in their mouths. They both had tasted poverty. They both knew that there were a lot of so-called sophisticated thinkers who had graduated from the best law schools in the country, like Sam Ervin, North Carolina senator, Harvard Law School. But of all the books that Sam Ervin had read, and he was a collector of books, he did not find in any of his law books a rationale for equality for the black man. And Lyndon Johnson did, because he had looked into the eyes of poor black people in Texas, in Washington, D.C. There's a very, very poignant story in the book. Lyndon Johnson was in the Senate, and sometimes his black driver would drive Lyndon Johnson's, you know, his papers and his books for the summer back to Texas. And Johnson had noticed that his black driver was sort of moping around the office because of this looming drive. And Johnson said, "Well, what's the matter? I mean, you'll be out of the office, out there in fresh air, and you'll be driving 7 or 8 days, and you can take your wife with you, and I'm going to give you a little spending money, so what's the matter?" And he said, "Well, Mr. Johnson, I have about the same rights as your dog when I'm out there traveling through the countryside. I can't sleep in the motels because of the color of my skin. I can't get a decent meal for my wife because she's black. And, Senator, it's just a very difficult trip for me because I'm practically living in the car during that trip. And it fairly broke Lyndon Johnson's heart to hear that. And I think he wanted to do something about that. His 1964 Civil Rights Act was one nail. His 1965 Voting Rights Act was a second nail. He thought the third nail in the coffin of white supremacy was the nomination of Thurgood Marshall to the Supreme Court.
It wasn't obvious, though, that he would be president and the person in a position to make that nomination. He did a little finagling on the in the background there, right?
Yes. Well,
to make the seat available.
Yes. There was no seat available. That's right. Kind of the magic of what happened during this moment in history. Tom Clark was an associate justice. He was in good health, had never told anybody in his family that he was leaving this lifetime appointment. And all of a sudden, one day he goes home and tells his wife and children, hey, I'm stepping down. And they were surprised because President Johnson had went to Tom Clark and said, hey, Tom. And now they had known each other since they were in their 20s back in Texas. He said, Tom, your boy, Ramsey. Love that boy.
Ramsey Clark.
Yeah, Ramsey Clark. Love that boy. And I actually want to appoint him attorney general. And I know you so proud of your son, and you would love that to happen. But, Tom, people are going to accuse me of nepotism. And I just can't do it. I can't do it unless his daddy steps down from the Supreme Court. Now, if you were to do that, Tom, I would, snapping my finger, I would get your boy, Ramsey Clark, to be my next attorney general. Now, you think about that, because I know you love that boy as much as I do. And Lyndon Johnson was brilliant at appealing to the heartstrings of a father who only had one son, and who wouldn't want their son to become the United States Attorney General. Tom Clark stepped down. Lyndon Johnson did not tell a soul except for a couple close advisors and that he was going to nominate Thurgood Marshall to the U.S. Supreme Court. He summoned him to the White House, and he made this very surprising announcement in mid-July 1967 that he was going to nominate Thurgood Marshall. All the Southern senators were outraged. Lyndon, how could you do this to us? We come from the same class of people. You are a traitor. And they were angry. But he was Lyndon Johnson. He knew what he had to do. He had told one of his aides, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful quote. He said, "But nominating Thurgood Marshall to the Supreme Court, I'm going to finish what Abraham Lincoln started." And that's just a beautiful, beautiful quote. He was talking about freedom. Lyndon Johnson wanted to emancipate the entire American legal profession by nominating and getting Thurgood Marshall confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court. He emancipated the American judicial system.
We're talking about the life and times of Thurgood Marshall. My guest is Will Haygood, award-winning journalist and author. His latest book is entitled Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed America. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Thurgood Marshall was a crusading attorney and civil rights activist who led the fight for school desegregation and equal pay for black teachers. After Supreme Court, he was the first African-American to be nominated and then confirmed to a place on the U.S. Supreme Court. After he died in 1993, the Washington Afro-American in an editorial said, "We make movies about Malcolm X. We get a holiday to honor Dr. Martin Luther King. But every day we live the legacy of Justice Thurgood Marshall." Award-winning author and journalist Will Haygood has written about the life and times and legacy of Marshall. His new book is entitled Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed America. He will speak tonight at the Lincoln Theater. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. I wanted to ask you about your book, The Butler. It was entitled The Butler, A Witness to History. It was based on a 2008 Washington Post story you wrote about a White House butler. Of course, we know the book inspired the 2013 Oscar-nominated movie Lee Daniels' The Butler. That was about perhaps the most overlooked main character throughout the decades in the White House, right? Yeah. Thurgood Marshall is hardly an overlooked figure. How is it different writing about people from two so very different perspectives?
On the day that Thurgood Marshall was nominated, summoned to the White House, there were three butlers on duty. One of those butlers who served Thurgood Marshall that day was Eugene Allen, the butler who I wrote about. It was amazing because I have no doubt that Mr. Allen, who was born in Virginia, seat of the Confederacy, had worked in the White House since 1952. And so at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, the most powerful address in the world. And yet in the 50s and some of the 60s, he could go back home to his native Virginia and couldn't try on a suit in a store because of the color of his skin. And here he is, a man in a service job who loved his country, who is looking at the man who maybe is about to ascend to the highest court in the land. And I thought there was something very poignant about these two men whose lives were wrapped around the haunting racial story of this nation. Marshall's upbringing, much better than Mr. Allen's upbringing. Mr. Allen's mother was white. His father was killed. Thurgood Marshall had two stable parents, but he was born in a very segregated city. Mr. Allen never could have gone to college. Didn't even go to high school. I mean, he was just dirt poor. Was a house boy when he was very young, and learned how to cook and got jobs in hotels. And then, as fortune, destiny, luck would have it, got a job in the White House. Thurgood Marshall was fighting for people like Mr. Allen all his life.
You dedicated the book to two well-known Columbus residents, Michael B. Coleman and Larry James. What's that about?
They've both been wonderful friends, wonderful figures in this city. And I even knew before I wrote one word of this book that I wanted my next big book to be dedicated to these two figures. They've followed my writing career for years. They've always sent me inspiring notes. They've hosted book events for me. And they've proven to me that you don't have to be a star OSU football player to get some attention in this city. And so that's made me feel good.
Richard in the Short North, you're on the air. Hi, Richard.
Good morning, Ann. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm very interested in this topic because Justice Marshall and Justice William O. Douglas have been heroes all my adult life. And I have been reading about, and including Sam Irvin, the way he was at the Watergate hearing. But I read up a little bit more on the confirmation of Mr. Marshall, and I was appalled at the racism that Sam Irvin and Strom Thurmond showed.
Yeah, how did they get away with it? Today it would be so shameful and horrible.
Here's how they did it. James Eastland, the Mississippi senator who was chairman, allowed no media in the hearing room, in room 2228. He allowed no media for one 20-minute session on the first day. And then Eastland said, everybody, get out to the media. Get out.
Which is unthinkable today.
Oh, yes, it wouldn't happen. But the transcription lives in history. And so my book becomes the spine of the book are these hearings. I mean, for instance, Senator Strom Thurmond is asking Thurgood Marshall about the Loving case, which was interracial
marriage case
in Virginia that went all the way to the Supreme Court. A black woman and a white man were married, and they were found in their bedroom, and the police raided their bedroom because they were an interracial couple in Virginia sleeping together, which was against the law. Thurgood Marshall's wife was of
Filipino.
Descent. And Strom Thurmond asked Marshall about the Loving case as a way to draw a spotlight onto Marshall's own marital situation. Marshall's first wife, who was black, had died, and Marshall remarried. A wonderful wife, Sissy Marshall, who had worked much of her life for the NAACP. So they were spiritually bonded together. And Strom Thurmond, who's asking Thurgood Marshall this case, trying to cast aspersions upon Marshall's marriage, Strom Thurmond had been sleeping with his family's black maid in the 60s and had fathered a child and was paying her hush money to keep this quiet. So there was a lot going on in room 2228, and not only just raw racism, there was hypocrisy as well.
Richard, thank you so much for that call. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about the life and times of Thurgood Marshall, of course, the first African-American on the United States Supreme Court. My guest is Will Haygood, award-winning journalist and author, and his latest book is entitled Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed America. This was all a huge, huge risk for President Johnson. He was in a world of hurt in Vietnam. You know, riots were occurring all over the urban United States. And he went out of his way to make the seat available on the court in the first place. And he shocked everybody when he did it. And I guess I was shocked that everyone was so shocked. I guess they thought no matter what, he would never go that far.
Well, yes, because he had so many other irons
in the fire. Right,
he really did, and he had to be committed to doing this. But by the second day of the hearings, Marshall was being grilled heavily. And as I said, previous hearings had always ended by the end of the first day. Mm-hmm. But by the second day's hearing, President Johnson was very nervous and said, "Uh oh." And he went and recruited a substitute nominee who happened to be William Coleman, who was a famous, highly regarded lawyer from Philadelphia, who had also worked with Thurgood Marshall on the Brown v. Board of Education case. This President Johnson summoned William Coleman to the White House in a secret meeting and said, look, my man is in trouble. Thurgood Marshall is in trouble. If I can't get him confirmed and I'm hell-bent on integrating the U.S. Supreme Court, will you be my nominee? And William Coleman thought about it. He was torn because he loved Thurgood Marshall. He was a dear friend of his. And he finally said at the end of this meeting, Mr. President, I just want the White House to do everything to get my good friend Thurgood Marshall confirmed. He's more than qualified. He's a legendary lawyer. He has argued 32 cases before the Supreme Court and won 29 of them. It was a unmatched record. He was a legal giant, and he knew it. Marshall knew it. But William Coleman did promise Johnson that he would go around and try to turn some other senators who didn't want Marshall on the high court. One of the interesting things about this, too, is that senators vote on U.S. Supreme Court nominees. It was unusual, almost unheard of, that U.S. House members would take to their floor to ostracize Thurgood Marshall. Mm-hmm. But there were many Southern congressmen who stood up on the floor of the House, and they had no business weighing in on this, and they went after Thurgood Marshall.
We're running out of time, but there were champions of Marshall in those Senate hearings.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that. Absolutely, and they were men like Senator Joe Tidings and Senator Birch Bayh and Senator Ted Kennedy, Everett Dirksen of Illinois, Republican, liberal, righteous. Marshall, he came out of the Senate, which you have to realize, I mean, what I'm sure many of your smart listeners do realize is that the Democrats were Dixiecrats for the most part.
Segregationists.
Segregationists. The Southerners were. So Marshall makes it out of the hearing to the full Senate where they have to vote on his nomination. Eastland arranges to where that nomination is sitting in limbo. Eastland is hoping that the FBI or someone can find dirt on Marshall to force some kind of filibuster. And so the Johnson White House had to get more than 62 votes. They had to do it to stop a filibuster. They got 62. They got 62. So it's very, in terms of history, it was a very narrow window that President Lyndon Johnson could get Marshall onto the court. And he realized that because after Lyndon Johnson came Richard Nixon, and Lyndon Johnson, his cabinet had a black member in it, Robert Weaver. Richard Nixon's cabinet had no blacks. And so it was highly unlikely that President Nixon would have nominated a black to the Supreme Court. So Lyndon Johnson saw that window and seized the moment. He seized the moment. The nation was hurting from massive rioting, and the rioting because of lack of opportunities, decades, centuries of unfair treatment. And so it all sort of came to an explosive point in the summer of 1967 when the great Thurgood Marshall was sitting and being judged by the U.S. Senate.
Well, Haygood, thanks so much for joining us today. I've really enjoyed it, as usual.
Thank you for having me.
It's Will Haygood. He is an award-winning journalist and author, many books. His latest is entitled Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed America. Will be speaking tonight at the Lincoln Theater. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shia Linnott, All Sides interns Trent Lammers, Ryan McFadden, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.